Recently, mental health apps have been hailed as a means of overcoming common barriers to treatment for mental illness such as cost, access, and social stigma. However, new research led by the University of Sydney has shown that some apps may be doing more harm than they are good. The research found that marketing for some mental health apps presented poor mental health as ubiquitous and implied that individuals can easily and effectively manage any mental health problems they may be experiencing via an app. We're joined now by Dr. Lisa Parker, lead author of the study, to find out a little bit more. Thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Hi, Sam. Thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely. Can you explain to us the key findings from this research?
Yeah, well, what we found was that looking at the advertising and marketing material of these common, prominent mental health apps, we found that, as you said, they presented poor or fragile health as being ubiquitous amongst the community. And we also found that they sort of pushed a message that people were responsible, should be responsible for their own mental well-being. So they're quite judgmental and individual-focused in that way.
And a common thing with mental health is a feeling of isolation, a feeling like other people don't experience what you do. What are the problems from implying that mental health problems are so ubiquitous and commonly experienced?
Yeah, so a couple of things, I suppose. Part of the problem with implying that they're ubiquitous is that it kind of medicalizes the normal ups and downs of everyday life and presents that as a medical condition that needs attention or treatment in some way. So I think that's a bit problematic. But I guess on the other side, the way that these apps presented everybody in the text and in the pictures that were in the screenshots of apps, they presented people as a very sort of narrow range. They were mostly wealthy in a family, mostly white, employed, and I felt that would alienate people who weren't necessarily captured by that demographic and make them feel perhaps even more isolated than they maybe already did.
So in their going for, you know, what they viewed as a broad market, they kind of really, you know, pushed a lot of other people even further to the periphery.
I think so. So I think if you're suffering mental anguish and you're not in that kind of dominant white middle class demographic, then you might flick through these apps looking for some help and think, well, I'm not represented here. I'm not the important person. And then that, you know, would potentially make you feel worse.
Now, how big is the risk that people with serious mental health problems and not, you know, sort of just ups and downs of daily life may be using apps as a replacement for help from a professional?
Yeah, so that's the other side of it. People might be going to these apps as a way of trying to get a self-diagnosis or self-management for a really serious medical condition that perhaps isn't suitable for being treated by an algorithm. You know, that they may actually be requiring some sort of personal assessment and assistance that is much more individualized than what an app can provide. So some people might be over-treating themselves and others might be under-treating themselves. So there's a few risks, I think, involved in the relying on apps.
And Lisa, even going back one step, what sort of help do these apps generally provide? What form do they take?
So, look, they do take, they are a variety of help, but the ones that we looked at tended to focus on things like stress and depression. A few other issues were mentioned, but stress and depression were the dominant ones. And they offered things like relaxation techniques, a bit of kind of cognitive behavioral type therapy things. So they were the main sorts of things that they offered. And many of them also offered this, what we call a track, share and compare facility, where they encourage the user to track or log in multiple times during the day and potentially share, so maybe log their mood and share that with friends or their serenity circle or something like that. So it becomes a little bit of a requirement to log in regularly, and you get lots of reminders to do so.
Which is obviously for people with, you know, mental health issue, it's a demand, constant demand on your resources.
It's a huge time burden, I think. Yeah, and you know, if you didn't feel up to doing it, and you're getting all these requirements and demands and reminders, that might again make you feel worse.
And now there are apps that are, you know, sponsored or made or approved by like Beyond Blue and other, you know, sort of mental health institutions that have expertise in the field. What situations can mental health apps, particularly ones that are approved by these sort of institutions, actually be useful?
Yeah, so there is a little bit of evidence out there about benefit from mental health apps. There's not a lot of evidence because evidence takes time to create, and these apps haven't been around for very long. But the evidence out there does suggest that some apps in certain situations may help. For example, a digital platform for cognitive behavioral therapy can be useful for some people. Or can be just as useful as attending a psychologist. So there likely is a place for digital mental health treatments, but I think that many of these apps are not filling what they promise.
And app stores or apps in general, the whole, you know, phone market is very fast-paced, high turnover where apps are added and removed all the time. Is there any kind of regulation or oversight for mental health apps in Australia or other countries?
So we looked at that, and there is some regulation, but it's quite siloed. So some regulators look at the content, some regulators look at privacy, some regulators look at financial issues. So there's a need for someone to take a little bit of oversight. But as you say, it's very difficult because apps are huge in number and regularly there's a high turnover. So we also focused on the developers, and we've written some guidelines that we hope would help developers who are serious and keen to put the patient or the user at the center of their product, some guidelines to help them do that. So I think that's another way of approaching it, to focus on the developer.
Absolutely. And Lisa, finally, I'd just like to ask for any of our listeners who may be considering using a mental health app or have used them and haven't necessarily, you know, derived much benefit from them, what should they look for in a mental health app if they are trying to find one that is useful versus one that isn't?
So I guess my suggestion would be look at a mental health app as something that can offer you a specific thing. So if you're looking for something to give you relaxation, then you might find a meditation app or a calming app helpful. But if you're looking to get an overall assessment of your mental health or a diagnosis, or you're not sure what kind of treatment you might need, then I would suggest going to see a person would be better than relying on an app algorithm.
Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Sam. It's been great.